Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another week's worth of programs. On the program today in this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with Philip Short, who has quite a bit of experience as a foreign correspondent. He worked for the London Times, The Economist, and also the BBC, various places around the world. He worked in China in the 1970s and early 80s and has returned there regularly ever since. He's the author of a recently published biography of Mao Zedong, which is titled Mao: A Life, published by Henry Holt. And he's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and was good enough to come and spend some time with us to talk about Mao and China. We're pleased to have him here. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much. I appreciate you.
Pleasure to be here.
When you went to China, it was just after Mao died in 76?
That's right. He died in September 76. And the BBC had been negotiating for some time to set up a bureau there, and they actually got permission about a month after his death. Bureaucracies grind slowly, so by the time I got there and I went to set up the BBC bureau, it was May, June of 77. But not a lot had changed in that time. It was still very isolated, very remote. I remember we were about 20 correspondents in all in Beijing, half of them from the Eastern Bloc, the former Soviet bloc countries, half of them from the West. And Beijing then was a place where even in the capital of China, as a foreigner, you walk down a street, you drew a crowd. Foreigners were that uncommon. There was nothing imported except for Albanian olive oil, North Korean cigarettes, and Rolex watches. Everything else was Chinese made, and a country that was still really very cut off from the outside world.
It must have been a tremendously challenging assignment for you.
Terrific. Absolutely true. I mean, one could not ask for more. And in my case, I just spent 3 years in Moscow. So I'd been in a communist society, and to come to China, also communist, but a very different kind of communism, a much more dynamic system where people were more willing to think for themselves, to struggle against each other within the Communist Party, was amazing. Mm-hmm. Above all, also a country with this extraordinarily rich and ancient culture, which, despite the Cultural Revolution, despite Mao, still underpinned Chinese life in all its variety. So it was great. And it was one of the things I'm very glad about was that I was there at that time, and therefore I'm in a position to make the comparison with China now, because China now is a different world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. China today is becoming so much like the rest of Asia. You go to provincial capitals in China, and frankly, they look like small versions of Bangkok or Singapore. Glass and concrete skyscrapers. Everyone using mobile phones. Successful young businessmen driving around in sports cars. Everything you find everywhere else. It's changing extraordinarily fast, and I would argue that although certainly China today is a dictatorship, no question, it's in no sense a democracy, it is not any longer in any meaningful sense communist. Mm-hmm. The economic system has become, in practice, capitalist, and the party is a party which is there in order to keep and to wield power. It's not ideologically communist in any way, and frankly, no one believes in communism in China anymore.
You talked about the contrast between the Soviet Union and China. When you came there, I talked about China being a much more dynamic kind of a place. And in addition to that, we know the history of the revolution has also been rather destructive. At that point, China had just gone through the Cultural Revolution. And reading about Mao and some of the things that he said and apparently believed, one gets the sense that the thing that he most wanted to avoid was a static kind of situation. That is, he had this idea that there should be, in some sense, a perpetual revolution, that he never really wanted it to stop. How much of that has to do with Mao himself, and is that or is it also in some way a reflection of China?
I think it is. It has to do with both. Mao was an extraordinary character. I mean, extraordinary is, in a sense, too weak a word. First of all, he was many different people rolled into one. He was a military strategist of genius in many senses. I mean, his military campaigns in the 1930s and 40s were not only extraordinarily successful, but they were extremely subtle and well thought out. He was a Machiavellian politician, fiendishly clever at manipulating others within the party. He was a visionary. He was a philosopher. He was a poet. He was a romantic. You know, one remembers the book not so long ago by his doctor about his relations with women. Yes, he was a romantic with women, but he was also a romantic in the sense you were just speaking about. Ideologically, he did believe in uninterrupted revolution. He wanted China to become a kind of red beacon to the rest of the world, encouraging revolutionaries everywhere. It would be the Middle Kingdom still, but a Middle Kingdom in a very revolutionary sense. And his life, which really spanned, he died at the age of 83, it spanned one of the most turbulent centuries in Chinese history. And for much of that time, he was the prime mover, the man who was determining the directions in which China would go. And during that period, China changed from being a decaying feudal autocracy to a modern nation state. History was compressed. Changes which took our countries hundreds of years took place in 30, 40 years there. Mm. So for all these reasons, and for the vastness of the canvas on which his life was played out, you're talking about a country which, you know, has between a fifth and a quarter of humanity, he is a wonderful subject for a biography and an absolutely fascinating yarn.
Mm. Well, he certainly came of age at a major turning point in China's history, and his generation was very important, played a very important role. I think he and others of his generation felt responsible for taking the helm and leading, so to speak, and leading the country into that future. So perhaps it's not surprising that he, you know, one might ask why Mao, but it's not surprising in a sense that because he was part of this generation that was there at sort of the right time in the right place.
He was very lucky. You know, there are generations which people are in their late teens or their early 20s at periods of change. I'm thinking of May 68 in France or the 60s in the United States. You know, civil rights, flower power, Haight-Ashbury. I mean, that was a good time to be young. Well, Mao was part of one of those very privileged generations. But, you know, why was it Mao rather than any of hundreds of other young men in that sort of position who came to dominate? And I think one reason is his determination, the almost palpable will to prevail, which illuminated the whole of his life. It was a major factor. The other thing, which was very important with Mao, he grew up, let's remember, in the late 19th century, in a little isolated village, going to the village school, learning the Confucian classics, and communism only came much later. The result was the sort of the bedrock of his thought was traditionally Chinese. Mm. And he was able to relate these new ideas that came in the First World War period, the early 20s, these new ideas like communism and anarchism and syndicalism to Chinese reality. He could make it comprehensible, communism comprehensible and acceptable to Chinese. And most of the others who'd been to universities in Moscow and been to France were not as well tuned in with Chinese thinking. And that, I think, was one of the key things that caused him to dominate, as well as his own abilities. I mean, he was an amazing man.
Well, that's, I think, a major part of the story would be his rise to the point where he was leading the party and then later became chairman of the People's Republic. And here, this is something that took more than 20 years. So this is a major chunk of history and a major chunk of his life. But one does have to ask this question at the beginning point where you had a point where there were a number of individuals who were all part of this together, and how it is one got from that point to the end point when he was the supreme leader and had managed to not only rise to the top but eliminate opposition.
Well, it wasn't easy. In the first 10 years or so, no, first 12 years that Mao was in the party, I mean, he was out of power six times. He was literally in disgrace. So it was. It wasn't that there was a kind of, you know, gradual climbing of the ladder. It was a much riskier, more unpredictable process than that. Mm-hmm. But he was able to assert himself partly because on all the major issues, he turned out to be right, and most of the others turned out to be wrong. And that proved to be very important after 1949, after they'd won power, because when Mao insisted on completely cloud cuckoo land schemes, unrealistic schemes like the Great Leap Forward, which was this idea that by mobilizing the people, China could outstrip the United States in industrial development, they followed. And they followed, everybody followed, the leadership, the rest of the leadership went along with it, because he had never been wrong. You know, he was the guy who'd brought them from nowhere to winning complete power in China. And at every tack of the way where people had argued against Mao, they had proved to have the weaker case. So that was a very important reason. The other reason was that Mao was extremely good at political manipulation. He would ally himself with a particular faction. He was so devious that nobody could see, and he planned, no one could see where he was going, what he was trying to do. And he would plan moves not just months, but years in advance, and let them slowly, slowly, slowly come to fruition. So he was a very clever political operator.
Our guest this morning in this first hour, Focus 580, Philip Short. He's been a foreign correspondent for The London Times, The Economist, and the BBC, and worked in China in the early 70s and early 80s. He is the author of a recently published biography of Mao Zedong, which is entitled Mao, A Life, published by Henry Holt. Questions are welcome. We have a caller here we'll get to. Others are certainly welcome to call. All we ask of callers is people try to be brief, just so we can accommodate as many different folks as possible. But anyone's welcome to call 333-WILL or 9455. That's for local folks, toll-free, anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Bloomington, Indiana. It's line number 4. Hello?
Hi. Hi. May I ask about China's forced abortion policies, especially the abortion and infanticide of girl babies? Maybe we better explain. China has a one-child-per-family policy, and the Chinese prefer boys over girls. So if a married couple can only have one child, they tend to abort the girls or kill them after birth. Two questions. I understand it's fairly clear that female infanticide is widespread in China. That's the first question. Second question. By now, killing all these girl babies, it must have led to some kind of a shortage of young women in China. Too many men, not enough women. How is the shortage of women affecting Chinese society?
Well, there's quite a lot of questions all kind of piled in there. My enthusiasm to answer, I just spilt my coffee. These things happen in the best-run studios. Anyway.
Well, you're not the first.
Now, you're quite right. There is a one-child policy in China. It has been modified to some extent in the rural areas, in that people can and often do have two children. It's discouraged, but it is happening to some extent. In the urban areas, basically people have one child. And I have to say, in places like Beijing, in the big cities, the one-child policy is pretty well accepted. There is no female infanticide if people have a daughter or a boy in the cities I'm talking about. That is not a problem. Now, female infanticide and abortion when these ultrasound tests show that the fetus is female. Female infanticide has happened in China and indeed in other parts of Asia as well, for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's nothing new. The Catholic missionaries, if you read a great deal of material which was gathered in the 19th century about this, it was already a big problem then. The one-child policy has certainly made it worse because Chinese peasants want a male heir to continue the family line. It's very much written into Confucian ideas that a male heir is important. And they do, when possible, get ultrasound tests. The only thing I would say to you is that if you talk to Chinese people, to particularly educated Chinese, even those who are against the government on many, many things, will say the one point on which they support the Chinese government is this one-child policy. I know that's a very controversial thing to say, but you've got to remember there are 1.3 billion Chinese today. Even with the one-child policy, it's going to go up to 1.6 billion in 2040. Without any kind of birth control, there would be a population which would not only be unfeedable, there wouldn't be the food for it, but which would grow so quickly that any kind of meaningful economic development, prosperity, any better lives for Chinese families would not be possible. So they would argue it's justified. You, I'm sure, would not, and many others listening with you would not agree with that, but that's the way they see it.
Can I ask you about the effect that hasn't this produced a shortage of young women?
I forgot to answer that. You're right. There is an imbalance, but it's not perhaps as great as you might think it is. I've seen figures suggesting something of the order of 53% of girls to 53% of boys to 47% of girls. That sort of order. So the imbalance is there, and that's quite a significant imbalance, but it hasn't gone beyond that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Other questions are welcome. If you'd like to give us a call, 333-WILL or 9455, same either way. That's for Champaign Urbana, folks. Toll free, 800-222-WILL. I think that many biographers, in an effort to explain Mao, have put a good deal of significance on his relationship with his father, saying that, it was a difficult relationship. Mr. Mao thought that young Zedong was never going to amount to anything, that he was lazy, he was no account, he had much too much fondness for book learning, more than he would just need to run the farm. And it does seem that later on that people like his father ended up sort of on the bad end of an awful lot of the revolution.
The receiving end.
The business end, so to speak. So one wonders, I suppose, one could make too much of this, but how important was that informing Mao's character?
I don't think it was. You're quite right. Many biographers have put a lot of emphasis on this. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, there have been attempts at psychological portraits based on the fact that Mao was the eldest son, and then when a young brother sibling came along, he felt abandoned by his mother and so on and so forth. I do not buy that at all. Mao's descriptions of his relations with his father, I think, are pretty normal for any adolescent child. In other words, adolescent children are usually, very often they have their moments of being intolerable and ungrateful and of rebellion. And Mao rebelled. So what's new? I think that there are interesting things in that family relationship nonetheless. One of them is that Mao's father supported him through his education. You rightly said his father thought Mao was too interested in book learning. He wanted him to work on the farm or to become an apprentice so he could support the family in their old age. And Mao wouldn't have any of that. But when Mao insisted on going off to Changsha, the capital, the secondary school, and then doing teacher training, the old man paid his fees. Now, that shows an aspect of Mao's father that Mao doesn't write about, doesn't talk about, that he was actually, when push came to shove, generous. And it also tells you something about Mao. Mao was never grateful to his father for those sacrifices. And I think, you know, we've talked about some of the better sides of Mao's character, his skills, his abilities, but he was very self-centered. He was not loyal. He was not grateful to anybody. His own political ends were what dominated his life. And his father was one of the earliest cases where Mao was thinking of himself, not of anyone else.
Well, it's a great departure from the traditional value of filial piety. Now, maybe, again, that would have been symptomatic of his generation that was in some sense rejecting tradition.
Yes, you're absolutely right. When Mao told his life story to Edgar Snow in 1936, he had a sentence in there, I hated my father. And that when they produced a Chinese translation of it, that sentence was taken out because it would resonate so badly with Chinese readers that anyone would say, I hated my father.
Mm-hmm. One, as you have said, perhaps part of his genius or his reason for success was the ability to take Western ideas, socialism, Marxism, and be able to apply them to the Chinese case, which was different. And I think, you know, one of the things that he's been credited with is the idea that whereas the Marxists thought that the revolution was going to come from the urban workers, Mao used the countryside and peasantry as his base. But he didn't start there. I think earlier on, he and others thought it indeed would be urban workers that would lead the revolution. And later he came to this idea that no, that in fact that's where it would happen. What led him to that understanding or that change?
It's very interesting, this. You can understand why these young men, these young intellectuals, look to the urban proletariat for the revolution, because, you know, to them, the peasantry was everything that was most backward, most blinkered, most benighted about China. It was that they were trying to get away from. They were looking to the industrial workers as, you know, the just shining heralds of the new industrialized revolution, industrialized state. And interestingly, the people who kept on saying to the Chinese communists, look, don't forget the peasants, were the Russians. It was the Comintern, first and foremost. And there's some very interesting and amusing telegrams, correspondence between Moscow and the Chinese communists in the early 1920s, where you can see the Russians getting more and more fed up with the obtuseness of these stupid Chinese intellectuals who will not understand that the peasants, in capital letters, are the people you should be thinking about. So there was a lot of pressure from there, which the Chinese really did not want to know about. There were a few experiments in southern China over peasants, but Mao really got interested when he went to Hunan, his home province. He went back to his home province in the winter of 1926, spring of 27, and there had been a huge peasant uprising. And he wrote a report. It's a remarkable document because it's almost kind of lyrical in its revolutionary intensity, talking about the peasants as being an upsurge of popular will that no force can resist. Well, that turned out to be premature, but in the end, he was right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're just about at the midpoint here. Let me just mention again, our guest is Philip Short. He has been foreign correspondent for the BBC, for The Economist, for the London Times, and also for a number of years worked in China. He has returned there regularly ever since. His home now is in southern France, and he's visiting the campus here to talk with journalism students and was good enough to come and talk with us about his recent biography of Mao Zedong, which is titled Mao, A Life, published by Henry Holt. And again, if you have questions, you can call us 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mao made it at least two tragic mistakes, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, which were his attempts to to engage in cultural, social engineering at a level maybe unprecedented in the history of the world. And I think, as you point out in the book, that as a result of his policies, more he managed to kill more of his own people than any leader in world history, more than Hitler, more than Stalin, more than Pol Pot. What, if it's possible to answer such a big question, what was he trying to do?
Yes, I must pick you up on the word kill. More people died under Mao's rule. There is a distinction because there's a distinction of responsibility. And most of those who died, 25 million people died of in the famine that followed the Great Leap Forward. The numbers who were killed because of purges or political movements set in motion directly by Mao were very much less. Now, what was Mao trying to do? Basically, I don't think his views, his broad aim changed that much since he was a young man, and it was to make China strong, to give China back its pride. And in a way, when the communists came to power in 1949, he made speech from Tiananmen Square proclaiming the establishment of the People's Republic. He said, you know, the Chinese people have stood up. Well, it's a simple phrase, but it sums up a lot of what he'd done. China, in the time when he was a young man, had been humiliated by the foreign powers. Foreign powers including America, Britain, France, Japan. There were discussions in European parliaments about partitioning China, dividing it up into spheres of influence. The British were going to have the Yangtze Valley, the French were going to have the Southwest. China was, it had sunk about as low as any great country can. It had no control over its own destiny. So to make China stand up. Now, come ahead to the Cultural Revolution, the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution. The Great Leap was basically an attempt to make China strong economically, a great economic power. It failed disastrously. And after that, Mao kind of gave up on economics, which were, he recognized, not his strong point. I mean, he really didn't understand economics. So to make China strong in what way? Ideologically, the point of the Cultural Revolution, it was not a power struggle per se. It was an attempt by Mao to so radicalize Chinese thought and the minds of the Chinese people that his revolutionary ideas would live on after him. And that, as I said, I use this phrase, China becoming like a red beacon, you know, an ideological holy grail shining out to the rest of the world. That was what he wanted. And, of course, it wasn't what the Chinese people wanted, so it failed. And I think, you know, part of the tragedy of Mao was that he knew by the time he died he was sufficiently lucid to have recognized that the Cultural Revolution was a failure. But in a sense, it had a sort of silver lining because all this tumult, all this anarchy that accompanied the Maoist interlude immunized the Chinese people against belief in great leaders. It made them put a premium on stability, which has been the basis for China's growth since Mao's death, for this extraordinarily dynamic and vigorous society that you find in China now.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It has been observed, and I apologize whether this was your observation or something that I read somewhere else, that what it is that he managed to do rather than so much perhaps influencing the way people acted or the way people lived, what he did influence was the way people thought.
That, I think, is the great difference between Stalin and Mao. I mean, Stalin cared about what people did. Hitler cared about who they were, what race. Mao cared about what they thought. And but the problem was, I mean, the great contradiction, and this in a way is what makes Mao such a fascinating character, are the contradictions in him. He wanted them to arrive themselves at their own ideas. He didn't want to dictate and say, you must think this. He wanted people to work things out for themselves. But the moment that they thought something he didn't like, or people thought in ways that he didn't approve of, he couldn't accept it. Mm. So
we have a couple of other callers. Let's go to Champagne first. That's line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. My apologies. I'm not quite sure we have things set up. Apparently the caller can't hear us.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. We can hear you now. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Short.
Yes, hi.
Hi. Just want to ask something connected with what you mentioned before, that just about asking what's your opinion on the sort of lasting legacy of Mao, the Chinese Revolution, and the Cultural Revolution. I don't mean so much in terms of what you mentioned about making China great or stability, but in terms of the original somehow program of the Chinese Revolution. So lasting legacy in terms of the position of women, the liberation of women, which was a central plank in the program of the Chinese Communist Party, the attempts to break the old sort of feudal attitude towards authority and develop a notion of equality, which I suppose in places like Europe happened via the French Revolution, and just the lasting effect of that in China, and also in terms of these sort of issues, it may be interesting to compare the position of China today with, say, India, where many of these questions are still yet to be solved or dealt with.
I think that's a very, very good point. If you do compare China today with India, and particularly in the case of women's rights, there is a huge difference. I think there's no question that Chinese women in the countryside have a better deal than Indian women. They have more freedom to choose who they marry. And I'm trying to give you a pragmatic answer, because if I give you an answer which just follows the marriage laws in China, it will all sound wonderful, as though everybody has complete equality. Well, that is not so, but it's a lot better than in India. And you asked about the extent to which women's equality had become a reality. You've got to go back to the starting point, because in China at the turn of the century, even into the 1920s in many cases, women had virtually no rights. Mm. All marriages were arranged. They had no choice whatever of who they were to marry. They didn't have property rights. They didn't have the right to own money, and so on and so forth. Well, coming from there, the Chinese women are in most respects under the law, just about all respects, the equal of men. Well, you then have to ask yourself, how much does that play through in practice? And you can ask that question about the United States. You can ask it about Britain. You can ask it about any country. But at least the legal framework is there. And in reality, too, particularly among the younger generation, kids of 20, 20 in the early 20s, in practice as well, equality does work out pretty well.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us approximate chronological dates of the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution? And could you say more about those two great events in China's history? And I'll hang up and listen.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. Fine. Your request for chronology is very well taken. I should have been more precise as we went along. I mean, the key dates, if you like, just to put it in perspective, 1911, the emperor was overthrown in the first Chinese Revolution. 1921, the Communist Party is formed. 1927, the guerrilla war begins between the communists and the nationalists. 1949, the communists win. The People's Republic is declared. And we then come on to 1958, the Great Leap Forward is launched. And the Great Leap was an attempt by Mao to, well, first of all, the decision was made, they'd already cooperativized, I'm afraid that is the word I have to use, agriculture. They made big cooperatives rather than individual farms. But the decision was made in 1958 to go further than that and to make communes. And communes were going to be bigger, first of all, thousands, some cases more than 10,000 people in one administrative unit. They were going to have their own sort of local government, schools, responsibility for schools and all those sorts of things, and they were to be the unit of production. And the idea was that by getting people together in very large numbers and mobilizing those people to work very hard, then China could catch up with Britain. The idea was to catch up with Britain in steel production in 3 years and catch up with the United States. And among the aberrations thrown up by this, it was a very untechnical, very ideological policy, and very metaphysical in some ways. Among the aberrations thrown up by it was this idea of backyard steel furnaces, where people went round collecting pots and pans and radiators and anything else that might be made of iron and smelting it down and producing some kind of gunge, which no one could use do anything with, but which in theory was, you know, a step towards making steel, and it was a disaster. You do need practical experience. You do need technique in order to industrialize. Human willpower is not enough. So with all the people who've been taken off the fields to work in these backyard steel factories and one thing and another, the harvests were extremely poor. Famine set in. 25 million died. Mao refused initially. Mao was challenged over this policy. He dug in his heels and refused to reverse it, which made things worse. And then eventually he did have to reverse it. And by now we're in 1961-62. For the next 3 years, he kind of sulked and worried about whether China was going eventually to become revisionist or capitalist. And the result of that sulking and his growing concerns over China's future ideological state was the Cultural Revolution. It broke out in 1966 and lasted in its acute form till 1969, but in other forms it really went on. That thinking went on till Mao's death in 1976. As I said, it was an attempt to by really almost reenacting a civil war between Red Guard groups, between workers' groups. It was an attempt to radicalize thinking, and it was very violent. You know, a million people died in the Cultural Revolution. They didn't just use their fists. There were incidents in one provincial capital. The rival groups used anti-aircraft missiles against each other, and an entire city block was just wiped off the face of the earth. This was quite tough stuff.
The question's been raised about this, and I'm sure is just how much Mao had to do with it, and how much of this was the responsibility of others, including his last wife Zheng Cheng and the famous Gang of Four. Now it could have been at a certain point. At that point, you could not have fingered the great helmsman. You would have had to find someone else to blame. How much did indeed he have to do with it?
He had everything to do with it. It was a very convenient excuse afterwards for those who didn't want to blame him for everything that had gone wrong in the Cultural Revolution. A very convenient excuse for them to be able to point to his wife and the other so-called radical leaders. But it was Mao who launched everything. It was Mao who orchestrated it. And he did so knowingly. Now, I'm not saying that he wanted people to fight with anti-aircraft missiles. He didn't. But he recognized that in the turbulence that he was stirring up, there was a great potential for violence and that there would be a lot of people killed. It proved very difficult once you stirred it up to kind of calm it down, to bring some kind of order back to China, which is why it took 3 years rather than 3 months, as he originally thought. But it was his doing. He wanted it. And when he died, just before he died, he rated the Cultural Revolution still as one of the two major things he had attempted in his life. I mean, one had been to overthrow the nationalists and win power in China for the communists. The other was the Cultural Revolution. But on the Cultural Revolution, if you read between the lines, there are, you know, questions in his mind about how successful it would prove.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Philip Short. He's been a foreign correspondent for the BBC and also for the London Times, and has written a biography of Mao Zedong, which came out earlier this year, titled Mao Alive, published by Henry Holt. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello. Hi, this is Yang from Champagne. After Mao passed away, China has been making pretty good progress there. But do you think, can you talk about what problem the country has and what suggestions you have? Maybe it's too general.
What problems the country has now, China has now?
Yeah.
Well, I can't. Are you from the mainland or are you
from... Yes, I'm from mainland.
Yeah. Well, you know about the problems probably better than I do, but let me tell you what I think the problems are.
Yeah.
And I do go back now every year. I was last there about 3 or 4 months ago. The biggest problem, I think, is corruption. I'm not saying anything new in that. It's particularly acute in the more remote districts, because you find county party committees who really do behave like little local despots, because they are in remote areas. And let's remember, you know, an awful lot of China is away from the main highways, away from the main cities. It's still a predominantly rural agricultural country. Because they're far away, they can do what they like, and there's very little control over them. And that causes deep and fierce resentment among the people. Higher level corruption is a problem too. You know, the red princelings, the children now probably in their 50s of the older generation of communist leaders have immense power because they have connections, they have links, they can get approval for big import export projects and so on, and there's a lot of corrupt activity there. Now, the Communist Party leadership and the government tries to crack down on it, but it's not really something that you can end until you have a much more pluralistic system with checks and balances and a greater degree of rule of law, which raises the big question. I said China today is communist only in name, but it is a dictatorship. When is it going to become a real working democracy? And the when part of that, I think one simply cannot answer. But you can say that there are trends underway which point to a more democratic system emerging. Let me just mention one. There is now a middle class in China which is becoming more and more established. People own their own houses, their own apartments. They have a stake in society. They are becoming bourgeois in many ways, and bourgeois political aspirations will undoubtedly follow, which means a democratic system. But how you get from here to there, well, we will have to kind of watch this space over the next years and probably decades. But that's the direction, and I think it's an irreversible direction in which China's going.
Okay, thank you.
All right, to another caller here, Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, given the timeline you gave earlier, I was curious if you could say anything about what Mao thought was happening, for example, to the United States during the 60s. If he thought it was encouraging, or maybe just an aberration, and also along the way, if you could tell me a little bit about how much information he had about what was going on in the outside world and where he focused his attention.
He did follow to some extent what was going on in the United States. The civil rights movement, for example, he met some black leaders. Robert Williams went over to Beijing, and they met. But it has to be said, the United States was not at the forefront of Mao's attention until the later part of the decade, when he started revising his view of the Great Power Triangle. by then, relations between China and the Soviet Union were extremely bad. Not on the point of war, but not that far away from it. And Mao decided to make a strategic partnership with the United States. Nixon responded, and as you know, the result was the Nixon visit to China in the early 1970s. Mao's main attention in foreign policy terms was on two things: the Soviet Union, China's neighbor, and also, you know, the great power nearby, the other focus of the communist world, and on the third world, which Mao thought was important for its revolutionary potential.
We are just about at the point that we're going to have to stop. My apologies, Stan. We have some people that we can't take. You know, what? I think probably one of my favorite quotes about history comes from one of Mao's associates, this famous quote that Zhou Enlai apparently was asked at one point what he thought of the French Revolution, and he said, "Too soon to tell." So that would be something a Chinese would say, given the fact that the country had a very long history. And I think today probably Chinese feel that the rest of the world doesn't really appreciate the fact that it is a country with a long history and that it was a world power at the time when the rest of the world were, you know, howling barbarians. How do they think about their place on the world stage or the place that they should have?
It's a question which is the Zhou Enlai story is delightful. I suspect it's apocryphal, but it fits perfectly. I mean, they do take this terribly long view of history. Mm. You know, they still argue about the rights and wrongs of prime ministers who lived 2,000 years ago, and that's why I think it's going to take them a long time to you know, find the what kind of place they want to put in their history for Mao. But China's place in the world, well, the Middle Kingdom is not just a Western expression. I mean, the Chinese do, deep down, regard themselves in that slightly arrogant way. They are the Middle Kingdom. And nationalism, because communist ideology has so eroded, nationalism has become more and more important. And it's one of the things now which really is, you know, it's the glue which helps to hold China together. From which two things. When the United States pushes over human rights and things, I mean, fine, it's something that the US and the West should do. But we should do so subtly. When we use it as a bludgeon, then all the nationalist hackles rise and it's counterproductive. And it also makes it much more difficult for China to make concessions over Taiwan and over Tibet.
Well, I'm sorry to say, we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, Philip Short, if you'd like to read his biography of Mao Zedong, it's titled Mao, A Life, and it's published by Henry Holt. Thank you very much.
Thank you.